This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 16th, 2003. Unanswered questions to 9/11. William Brunch, writing in the Philadelphia Daily News on September 11th, 2003, states, why don't we have answers to these 9/11 questions? William Bunch, as many others, are wondering and have wondered since September 11th why so many issues are unresolved. But if we look at the statements of Andreas van Bulow, who was the Minister for Research and Technology in the cabinet of former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, and for 25 years an SPD member of the German Parliament, heading the committees on intelligence
and the security agencies,
we see that really there are the smoking guns of 9/11 that explain, within the context of the work of intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, the Israeli Mossad, the answers to September 11th. Today on Taking Aim, the smoking guns of September 11th, of 9/11. Von Bulow states, whoever wants to understand the CIA's methods has to deal with its main tasks, covert operations. By organizing insurrections, terrorist attacks, usually combined with drugs and weapons trade and money laundering. This is essentially very simple. One arms violent people with weapons. Since, however, it must not under any circumstances come out that there is an intelligence agency behind it, von Bulow continues, all traces are erased with tremendous deployment of resources. I have the opinion, and this he confirms, von Bulow states, that the CIA spends 90% of its time this way, creating false leads. And if anyone suspects the collaboration of the agencies, he or she is accused of being a conspiracy madness. The truth often comes out, he says, only years later. And he quotes CIA chief Alan Dulles, the former CIA chief who was so enamored of covert operations. Quote, in case of doubt, I would even lie to Congress. Ralph?
Maya, Andreas von Bulow, and in this rather remarkable and explicit and upfront interview in the Tagesspiegel, the German daily newspaper, on January 13th of 2002. Von Bulow, who monitored and studied and actually was involved with German and American intelligence and security agencies, wrote a book on the subject called In the Name of the State. And he makes the point that the 26 intelligence services in the United States have a budget of at least, and that's the open budget, of $30 billion. Yet, von Bulow says, they purport to have been unable to prevent attacks that every intelligence agency knew were about to occur. They didn't even have an inkling, they claimed, that this would happen. And for 60 decisive minutes, these military and intelligence agencies allowed their fighter planes to remain on the ground, and 48 hours later, they were presenting a list of suicide attackers when we knew that seven of them were still alive. And where does this list come from? Why is it false? If I were the chief investigator in such a case, I would go public and give information on what these intelligence agencies were really up to. And then von Bulow addresses himself to the question of Mohammed Atta, who had spent so much time in Hamburg under the close direct observation and monitoring of the German intelligence agencies. Quote, "If this Atta was the decisive man in this operation, is it not strange that he took the risk of taking a small commuter plane that would reach Boston but a few minutes before the connecting time? Had this commuter plane been a few minutes late, he would not have been on the plane if he was there at all, that was hijacked. Why should a so-called sophisticated terrorist do this? One, by the way, can read on CNN's website that none of these names were on the official passenger lists. None of them had gone through check-in procedures. Why did none of the threatened pilots give the agreed-upon code 7700? The black boxes, which are fire and shockproof, the voice recordings containing valuable data. What's happened to them? Where are they?" Von Bülow continues, "Like assailants who in their preparations leave tracks behind them like a herd of stampeding elephants, the intelligence agencies have left their mark all over these operations. These so-called hijackers," Von Bülow states, "made payments with credit cards with their own names, reported to flight instructors with their own names, left behind rented cars with flight manuals in Arabic for jumbo jets, took with them on their so-called suicide trip wills and farewell letters, which then fall into the hands of the FBI because they are stored in a place where they will be found. Clues are left behind like a child's game of hide-and-seek. This is a transparent operation," says Von Bülow. "Is it not interesting as well that the obscure stock transactions which we have tracked in Germany, the amount of transactions in stocks in American Airlines, United Airlines, insurance companies increased 1,200% for a value of $15 billion? Who do you think is involved in that? Who would have the capacity to make those investments? The people who are in the know, the people who control. With the help of these attacks, the Western democracies are subject to brainwashing. The enemy image of anti-communism, which doesn't work, has been replaced, and we have given birth to a new replacement called suicidal terrorism. But this idea of the enemy image doesn't come from me. It's from Zbigniew Brzezinski," he states, "the policymakers of American intelligence who are preparing the way."
And if you want to see the complete Von Bülow interview, which Ralph and I suggest you read, it's on the internet at www.serendipity, that's serendipity.li/WOT/Von Bülow, which is VonBülow.htm. Referring to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the mastermind of the American strategy for seizing the control over the Central Asian republics.
And their oil and natural gas resources in particular.
Von Bülow states, "It was the strategy of the American security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, to destabilize the Soviet Union from neighboring Muslim countries. They lured the Russians into Afghanistan and then prepared them for a hell on earth, their Vietnam. With decisive support of the U.S. intelligence agencies, at least 30,000 Muslim fighters were trained in Afghanistan and Pakistan. One of them is, and this is important to note, Osama bin Laden." Von Bülow states, "I wrote years ago, it was out of this brood that the Taliban grew up in Afghanistan, who had been brought up in the Quranic schools financed by American and Saudi funds. The Taliban, who are now terrorizing the country and destroying it." Quote, now this is Von Bülow speaking. In other words, it is the Taliban funded by the CIA and the Saudis at the behest of the Central American, of the Central Intelligence Agency. To talk about the funding, of the U.S. funding and the U.S. creation of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, it is important to look at General Gul Hamid's statements. General Gul Hamid, who was the Director General of the Pakistani Intelligence Services, the ISI. Ralph, did you want to say something?
No, go ahead, Maya, please.
Now, we quoted last week in our program 9/11 and the Capitalist State statements by General Gul Hamid on who he thought was involved, who he thought was behind 9/11, namely elements of the U.S. intelligence, the U.S. Air Force, and the Israeli Mossad. In referring to the creation of al-Qaeda and why General Gul Hamid states that Osama bin Laden definitely, in his opinion, was not at all involved in the events of 9/11, Gul Hamid states that the Islamic fundamentalists got their big boost in the modern age as CIA assets in the covert campaign I was involved with to force the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Note, he states he was directly involved in this campaign. Bush Sr., he remarks, was vice president during that entire campaign. The ISI, the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, coordinated the entire operation in Afghanistan. I know this firsthand, as I was the director general of the ISI at the time. This is General Gul Hamid in an interview with Arno de Borgrave of the Washington Times and UPI. Ralph?
Well, what is significant about the elaborate descriptions of both Andreas von Bülow and General Gul Hamid is that they speak from direct and on-hand experience and knowledge of these specific false flag operations. They did not go unnoted in the press. The Germans were tracking 7/11 conspirators as early as 1998. The New York Times wrote, under the authorship of Desmond Buckler on January 18, 2003, quote, 3 years before the September 11th attacks, Germans' domestic intelligence service tracked completely prominent members of a Hamburg cell that were said to have planned and executed the aircraft hijackings, according to newly obtained documents. These documents include intelligence reports, complete surveillance logs, transcripts of intercepted phone calls, telephone calls that contradict public claims that the German intelligence agencies knew little about the members of the Hamburg cell. The records show, as early as 1998, the Germans monitored all communications, all meetings between the men and any who came to see them. The surveillance would lead a year later to the Hamburg apartment where Mohammed Atta and others were living while attending universities. And the article goes on to determine that Mohammed Atta and his putative associates were under the complete control and surveillance of German intelligence, and with it, the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yes, Ralph, to go back again to the history of the formation of al-Qaeda, in an article by Patrick Martin, January 22, 2002, that appeared in the Worldwide Socialist website, he remarks that the founding father, that title of al-Qaeda, goes to Ronald Reagan's CIA director, William Casey, and that it was William Casey specifically who initiated the campaign to recruit the Islamic militants from all over the world to come to Afghanistan, and that the fundamentalists came from dozens of countries, from Morocco to Indonesia, and including the Muslims from the United States, particularly black Muslims, who traveled to Afghanistan under the CIA auspices with CIA funding, received trainings in weapons and explosives from CIA trainers, and went into combat with U.S.-supplied arms. In fact, Osama bin Laden was a product of this process, going to Afghanistan in the early 1980s. So here we have, and stating specifically, the role of the United States in creating what is now called the Terror Network. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who we mentioned before, told the French newspaper, quote, which was more important in world history, the Taliban or the fall of the Soviet Empire? And that was in an interview with Vincent Javert in Le Nouvel Observateur, January 15th through 21st, 1998. So here we have the CIA creating and funding and working with other aspects of the U.S. intelligence agencies and the Pentagon in creating what is now called the Terror Network that is blamed for the events of 9/11.
What's interesting in particular about the terror network as it's described is that von Bülow, having established and the New York Times having confirmed that the activities of Mohammed Atta and these putative terrorists were not just monitored in detail, but every communication that they made and every party that they encountered was noted and recorded and documents filed in the intelligence agencies, in the German intelligence agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. Here, the Washington Post on August 29, 2002. German intelligence states the hijackers picked the Trade Center as a target in 2000. The suspected September 11th suicide pilots stated more than a year before that they would kill thousands in the World Trade Center. Federal prosecutor Kay Nehm described the hijackers' words. Nehm said the Hamburg hijackers began planning the attacks on the United States using aircraft in early October 1999, and she particularizes that the hijacker Marwan al-Shehhi specified the World Trade Center explicitly in conversations with a librarian in April 2000. All of this, by the way, fully in the hands of the German intelligence and the Central Intelligence Agency. And what's particularly interesting about this is that for 4 years while living in Hamburg, Mohammed Atta was part of what was called a, quote, joint venture between the United States and German governments. In an important article by the investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker, who has monitored with particular importance, I should say, the activities of the putative hijackers in Venice, Florida, where they were supposedly trained on Piper Cub and Cessna aircraft. He describes how Mohammed Atta was part of a joint venture between the U.S. and German governments, a, quote, an elite international program run by a little-known private organization whose principal figures were David Rockefeller and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The joint funded government effort picked up the tab for all Mohammed Atta's travel from Cairo to Istanbul, from Aleppo in Syria for the years 1994 and 1995, and employed him during 1996 and 1997. His financial relationship with the United States and German government extended back to his initial move from Egypt to Germany in 1992. He had been recruited in Cairo by a mysterious German couple dubbed the hijacker sponsors by an account in the Chicago Tribune. Mohammed Atta enjoyed the patronage of a government initiative known as the Congress Bundestag Program, overseen by the United States State Department and the German Ministry of Economic and Cooperation Development, the equivalent of the U.S. Agency for International Development and Intelligence Front. Mohammed Atta was on the payroll of this intelligence front operation for the entire period of his stay in Hamburg, and it is documented up to 1 month before the 9/11 attacks. A seven-line report by the German newspaper Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung on October 18, 2001, Atta was the tutor for scholarship holders. And the story quotes spokesman for another organization called the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, described as a German international further education organization, which was in fact funded by intelligence agencies paying Hamburg cadre principal Atta between 1995 and 1997. The U.S. end of this program was run out of an address at United Nations Plaza in New York by CDS and International. CDS stands for Karl Duisberg Society, the name of its German counterpart in Cologne, the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, named for Karl Duisberg, a German chemist and industrialist who headed the Bayer Corporation. The list of elite power brokers backing the CDS program ranges from Kissinger and Rockefeller, as mentioned, and included former President Bill Clinton, former First Lady Hillary Clinton, and Clinton White House advisor Ira Magaziner. there is no question here as to the character of the operations of Mohammed Atta.
Ralph, the research that you cite is much more extensive and intensive than that revealed in the mainstream press. Yet the Chicago Sun-Times, in an article September 16, 2001, hijackers trained openly, goes into the knowledge within the United States of the actual flight training, flight school training, and also into some of the biographies of the so-called hijackers, including Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shahihi, who both attended the Hamburg Technical University. And Hamburg is a port city in Germany, which has, according to the Sun-Times, more than 100,000 Muslim residents, and a fifth of the school's 1,000 students are foreigner. And Mohammed Atta attended this school for 8 years, and he earned a master's degree in construction engineering. He was not only a tutor, as you mentioned, he was the school director of the Islamic Working Group and was listed as such in the official school records. Now, al-Shahihi, on the other hand, enrolled, hardly ever went to classes, and but shared an apartment with Mohammed Atta in beginning in autumn 1998. And in that apartment, they had Quranic study groups. They were very devout, which is not in keeping with the description and the research and the investigation and the lifestyle, into the lifestyle of Mohammed Atta once he was in the United States, nor into a profile of Mohammed Atta as somebody who would be with al-Qaeda and fighting against the demonic United States,
actually,
rather than as an agent of the United States.
In fact, Maya, we'll deal with the lifestyle of Mohammed Atta, who traveled under intelligence agency funding back and forth from Hamburg, who was approached and recruited by the director of Hoffman Aviation, Rudy Dekkers, a Dutch national, and Arne Kruithof, another Dutch national, who in fact were involved with both intelligence agencies and organized crime and in drug trafficking, as has been documented by the Venice Gondolier and by the investigative reporter Daniel Hofziger. The flight school owner from whom they were supposed to have taken instruction in Venice, Florida, had links to international organized crime. The San Francisco Chronicle on the September 21st, 2001, went into considerable detail about this. Rudy Dekker and Arne Kruithof, where the alleged hijackers received their flying instructions, were, quote, laundering large sums of money from major crime and terrorist organizations, laundering with organized crime and drug money in the billions. Rudy Dekkers, the flight school owner, was widely interviewed on television after 9/11. He had been marketing his flight school actively, not in the south of Florida, but in Hamburg, Germany, where they approached Mohammed Atta and his associates, who then left Hamburg, moved to Florida on the intelligence agency funding that we've described, rolled immediately into flight school, and both so-called ringleaders, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehi, who were accused of piloting the aircraft into the World Trade Center, learned to fly at the Hoffman Aviation Flight School of Rudy Dekkers. Of course, what are we talking about here? Learning to fly what? Cessnas? Dekkers had undertaken a massive European marketing campaign within this milieu, recruiting such people. Foreign nationals came to account for 80% of the student pilots enrolled with him. He was training 400 such foreign nationals a year, all of them carefully selected from operations that were monitored by intelligence, funded by intelligence. Let's remind ourselves that the people we are discussing were all on watch lists of the FBI and the FAA, supposedly wanted men. According to the German prosecutors, when Mohammed Atta moved from Germany to Rudy Dekker's flight school, four other members of his group also moved to Venice, Florida to train as pilots, all known to the authorities, both in Germany and the United States. Dekkers said that the pilots showed up at his flight school with fistfuls of dollars, 10,000 of them laying across his counter. And indeed, Hofziger put the question, but what if it were the other way around? What if Mohammed didn't go to the mountain in the guise of the portly Dekkers? came to Mohammed. So why was Rudy Decker's marketing in Germany, where so-called terrorists are located, and then moving them to the United States? It bears closest scrutiny. And the Venice Gondolier carried the headline, Huffman Aviation, no stranger to headlines associated with organized crime involving $17 million in various operations. And indeed, the article, Rudy Decker's and the Lone Nut Cadre Theory from London to Venice, Florida, macro to micro, quote, a major flight training operation funneling hundreds of foreign national pilots here, noise complaints filling city council meetings. During a period of 2 hours, 90 flights flew over, 15 planes overhead, six times each in this small community. Wrote about Rudy Decker's, his $500,000 yacht rocks at anchor in Naples, Florida. He doesn't obtain that money, the article continues, from renting airtime to train young men to fly Piper Cubs and Cessnas. Two Dutch nationals, Arne Kruithof and Rudy Decker's, buying two flight training schools in Venice, Florida, and then extensive marketing in Belgium and Germany, now with yachts and half millions of dollars to throw around, the school a most remarkable success. But the article framed the issue. The Sarasota FBI office, responsible for the Venice airport investigations, has not offered their version of what Rudy Decker's is up to. For Middle Eastern so-called terrorists were wandering the Florida Panhandle and Gulf Coast without any impediment. Might the CIA have been training these operatives as part of an intelligence operation? Might that explain the FBI's lack of interest in the two Venice Dutch boys? What are they doing hiding in Venice, Florida? Asked the Boston Globe. The director of an Islamic studies think tank in Tampa was proclaimed the leader of Islamic Jihad in 1996. Then the new think tank director was held by the government for 3.5 years on secret evidence and afterwards released, but in constant contact with the putative hijackers.
Ralph, on October 24th, 2002, Daniel Hopsicker again showed a connection between Huffman Aviation of Rudy Decker and the drug trade. The plane was seized that belonged to Wallace J. Hilliard of Naples, Florida, a multimillionaire businessman and a self-styled Mormon bishop, and it turns out a secret owner of Huffman Aviation with Rudy Decker at the Venice airport since Rudy Decker had purchased it in 1999. And this plane was seized by federal agents in July of 2000 and reported by Daniel Hopsicker in 2002. And it contained more than 30 pounds of heroin. And it had been seized at the Orlando Executive Airport. So here we have the company with whom Rudy Decker is sharing.
And beyond that, it's important to note that Mohammed Atta, while attending the school of Rudy Decker, was living in the apartment of Charlie Voss, who was a supposed bookkeeper at the Decker Flight School, Huffman Aviation, but we find, in fact, was an Iran-Contra pilot who had operated C-130s in those operations, the perfect host for Mohammed Atta and company. And
the connections go on, Ralph, because Wally Hilliard, who was running the charter jet service, Plane 1 Leasing, from which the jet that carried the 30 pounds of heroin was seized by federal agents, even after this had happened, the Governor Jeb Bush of Florida and Florida Secretary of State Catherine Harris were providing celebrity endorsement for Hilliard's operation well after that Learjet N351WB was seized by the DEA agents.
Now, it's instructive to note the long association of Governor Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris to Huffman Aviation and to Decker's and Kruithof, not only their endorsement, but their direction of state Florida support for these operations. Because the exposure of the role of Huffman Aviation, the exposure of the role of the flight school with the putative terrorists, the exposure of the role of the National Security Agency's base in Venice, Florida, a principal base of the National Security Administration, the exposure of the role of Jackson Stevens of the National Security Administration with respect to the small town of Venice, Florida, and the Huffman Aviation, the exposure of all this led to a very instructive event. The Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated all evidence. Quote, "They took all our files," said one local law enforcement agency after shaking his head ruefully when asked if Rudy had any local priors. "I can't tell you now. All the files are gone." Well, how were they taken? They loaded two Ryder trucks right outside the police station window. They drove them right onto a C-130 military cargo plane at Saratoga Airport, which flew out with Jeff Bush aboard. All the files in all the police stations, one after one, a convoy of Ryder trucks then from station to station, collecting up any data, any files, putting it on a C-130, the files disappearing into a C-130 with Jeb Bush aboard, heading for Washington, D.C. That is, in fact, the context. Indeed, the Pentagon was confronted by this, and indeed confronted by something more fundamental, because Newsweek reported that the so-called terrorist pilots were trained at U.S. military installations and U.S. military schools. They received training at U.S. military facilities, according to a flurry of stories between September 15th and 17th in the Washington Post, Newsweek, and Knight Ritter newspaper.
Yes, Ralph. The Newsweek article by George Werfritz, Catherine Skip, and John Barry, alleged hijackers have trained at U.S. bases. Now, the information that they got about this was from the FBI. It says U.S. military sources have given the FBI information that five of the alleged hijackers who were in Tuesday's terror attacks, remember they're writing September 15th in 2001, received training at secure U.S. military installations in the 1990s.
The Knight Ritter news account, Maya, is even more specific. It states, quote, "Muhammad Atta attended International Officer School at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama," and that's an intelligence operation at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery. No one goes to Officer School at Maxwell Air Force Base for sensitive training without being thoroughly screened and identified. In addition, Abdulaziz Alamari was at the Aerospace School at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. Saeed Ahmadi attended the Defense Language Institute, a Defense Department Language Institute in Monterey, California. Indeed, the foreign nationals were training at the Pensacola Naval Air Station and cleared through U.S. Air Force International Officers School, requiring U.S. Air Force sanction and connections at both intelligence and decision-making levels.
And Saeed Ahmadi and Ahmed Al-Nami were among the four men allegedly who commandeered the United Airlines Flight 93, the one that crashed into rural Pennsylvania, and the circumstances of that crash are another of the unanswered questions, because the debris, the scattering of the debris, is not consonant with the official fiction. Now, the third man who studied in Pensacola, Ahmed Al-Maghadi, is allegedly the hijacker of United Airlines Flight 75, which hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Remember, these people studied at military schools, U.S. official military schools.
And they gave as their home and contact address the Pensacola Naval Air Station, inducing even Senator Bill Nelson of Florida to request a response from the Attorney General and the Justice Department when he inquired specifically about the fact that three of the terrorists, 19, listed the Pensacola Naval Air Station as their home address the hands of intelligence all over these operations.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen, coming to you over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, The Smoking Guns of 9/11. This and our other Taking Aim programs can be heard in our program archive on our website, www.takingaim.info. Ralph, let's return a bit more to Muhammad Atta and his lifestyle in the United States. It's been revealed that Muhammad Atta had his own email listserv. Imagine a man who is planning massive attacks in the United States, living a life, one, under aliases until April 2000, and also moving around the Florida's Gulf Coast. Before he moved to Venice, he lived in Charlotte County, which is south of Venice, and there he also attended flight schools for short periods of time, the longest being in Venice at Huffman Aviation. Now, can you imagine having polemical email listservs if you're trying to be undercover and to plan an operation, and here you're sending out far and wide discussions, and particularly these are discussions about the Islamic community here and abroad.
The pattern here that we've observed and that we've documented is a fairly standard one in false flag operations. Wherever Muhammad Atta shows himself, he leaves an explicit trail. Newsweek reported in a detailed article on the 24th of September 2001, the title of which is Bush, We Are at War. Last week, Atta and two of his buddies went out for a bender at a seafood bar called Shuckum's. Atta drank five Stoli and fruit juices, and the others drank rum and coke. They became agitated. They shouted curse words in Arabic, including a particularly blasphemous one that translates as, and I'm quoting from Newsweek, fuck God. There was a squabble. The waitress tried to collect the bill, and Muhammad Atta shouted, I work for American Airlines. I'm a pilot. What makes you think I'd have a problem paying this bill? Later, Muhammad Atta would be quoted as having visited a flight school in Tennessee where he requested the ability to pilot planes over sensitive areas to monitor them, and declaring, I am a pilot. I'm going to be flying an American Airlines plane, leaving the transparent false information intelligence trail characteristic of the false Lee Harvey Oswalds that were sighted everywhere, shooting the other people's targets, showing up at a used car a Ford dealership in Bolton, Texas, and declaring, I've just returned from the Soviet Union, and I am a defector, and I am going to be carrying out an operation in the United States, the false information trail that has the hand of intelligence all over it.
Not only Newsweek, Ralph, but the St. Petersburg Times on September 13th, 2001, 1 day after the 2 days after the 9/11 attacks. FBI seizes records of students at flight schools, an article by Barry Klein, Wes Allison, Catherine Wexler, and Jeff Testerman. In other words, a team of the St. Petersburg Times reporters did a lot of research, and they, too, tracked Muhammad Atta's whereabouts prior to September 11th. And Tony Amos was the night manager at Shuckum's Bar in Hollywood, and they talked to the actual bartender who served Muhammad Atta, and that was Patricia Idrisi. And she's the one who stated explicitly that Muhammad Atta had got offended and said, quote, I'm a pilot for American Airlines and I can pay my bill. Remember, that's referring to American Airlines Flight 11, the very plane that went into the North Tower. Idrisi said that Muhammad Atta and Marwan Shahi were wasted, and she directed them to a Chinese restaurant a few doors down. They went to the Chinese restaurant after they were already drunk, and they then returned again to Shuckum's. Again they returned. And this is the blatant activities of Mohammed Atta prior to September 11th, the so-called ringleader of the hijackers. Again, let's look at the what is claimed to be the actions of Mohammed Atta prior to the flight of American Airlines 11. He rents a car. He drives to Portland. He rents an Alamo car in Boston, drives it to Portland, Maine, and then takes a plane back to Boston. Meanwhile, he leaves bags in a hotel in Boston. Included in these bags is a videotape of how to fly the big jumbo jets. The bags that are left in Boston, and again, he has other bags, other suitcases, which are on the airplane that he takes from Portland, Maine. Now, he may have made the connection to the American Airlines Flight 11, but his bags didn't. There was no time for the bags to be transferred from the Portland commuter flight, which had 8 passengers on it. Call that timing. His bags didn't make it. In all probability, he may not have made it. This is not the planning for a massive action.
As von Bülow described it, and this is an account that occurs again in the Los Angeles Times on the 20th of September, the occurrence at Logan International Airport in Boston had strange characteristics. The presumptive hijackers about to go into an airport to get on a plane, to take airplanes and fly them into the World Trade Center, got into a shouting match, a pissing contest, with someone who they felt was trying to take their parking space. Just what you would expect conspirators in such an undertaking to do. They got out of their car and in heavily Arabic-inflected English began to curse and yell. So much so, they called such attention to themselves that the person in the car directed to the police, to the car from which these people had left for the airport. In this car was information about where they were staying in a Boston hotel room, and lo and behold, in the luggage were airline uniforms, a video of commercial aircraft, and a suicide note. It is a clear demonstration of the false trail led by an intelligence operation.
Also, Ralph, Daniel Hopsicker went and he videotaped a 3-hour interview with 21-year-old Amanda Keller, who was Mohammed Atta's live-in girlfriend. And she had some revealing details of Mohammed Atta's life in Venice. She stated that Atta and his closest associates were not only drinkers, but they were habitual cocaine users. Quote, they were always drinking, always beer or wine, and sometimes rum. And she's asked by Hopsicker, you saw Mohammed Atta do coke? She says, yeah. The first time I saw him, he borrowed a dollar from me to roll up as a straw, and then asked me if I wanted to do a line laid out on a glass table in the living room. And then, not only did they snort coke, not she, but Mohammed Atta and his cronies, but when they ran out, she said, they went to the Florida Flight Training School, the one that was owned by Arnie Krutoff, and that's where they acquired more cocaine. Ralph.
Mohammed Atta's father in Cairo on September 12th told Associated Press, my son is not dead. I spoke to him today. He is perfectly well. He has always enjoyed a very close relationship with governments and their agencies, said the father of Mohammed Atta on September 12th, avowing that his son was alive and well, and that he had spoken to him that very day. Reported in Al-Aram, carried by Associated Press. And indeed, in, as the Jerusalem Post would acknowledge, in the most egregious instance, a dozen Israeli spies were operating out of a Hollywood, Florida address, 4220 Sheridan Street, a block away from 3389 Sheridan Street, the apartment where Mohammed Atta was living with three other men. And indeed, this was the 60 intelligence agencies that have been described, intelligence operative that have been described on ABC Frontline and Fox News as part of the Mossad operation, not just monitoring Mohammed Atta and his associates, but in constant and reported contact with them. Prior to the events, these are operatives run by intelligence.
Ralph, aside from Mohammed Atta, we have the revelations of other of the hijackers tracked by the intelligence operations and run by the intelligence operations. In Newsweek, The Hijackers We Let Escape by Michael Isikoff and Daniel Kladman, an extensive article that appeared June 10th. This June 10th of 2002, and they are discussing Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and the hijackers of American Flight 77 that went into the Pentagon. This is Al-Hamzi and Al-Midar. And these two had attended meetings of the Al-Qaeda, an Al-Qaeda gathering, and they say in the Newsweek article, quote, a few days earlier, U.S. intelligence had gotten wind of the Al-Qaeda gathering. Special Branch Malaysia Security Service agreed to follow and photograph the suspected terrorists. But what's astonishing and what leads us to the conclusion that the CIA wasn't just tracking these people, that they were operatives, is that the CIA, according to the Malaysians, quote, did nothing with the information. Agency officials didn't tell the INS, which could have turned them away at the border, nor did they notify the FBI, which could have covertly tracked them to find out their mission. And Newsweek continues, instead, during the year and 9 months after the CIA identified them, Al-Hamzi and Al-Midar lived openly in the United States, using their real names, obtaining driver's licenses, opening bank accounts, enrolling in flight schools, until the morning of September 11th, when they walked aboard American Airlines Flight 77 and crashed it into the Pentagon. In fact, when Al-Midar's visa expired, the State Department issued him a new visa for remaining in the United States, and this was in late 2000.
Well, actually, Maya, there's a reason for that. As Michael Isikoff in Newsweek made clear, the two of the hijackers were living with a Federal Bureau of high-level FBI informant, living together, working together, planning together, moving together, reporting together, controlled together. Newsweek, 9/16/02.
And this took place in San Diego. In fact, Al-Hamzi was listed in the San Diego phone book. In the phone book. So there was no doubt where Al-Hamzi and Al-Midar were. This is during an 18-month period in the United States. It's supposedly working with Mohammed Atta and Hani Hanjour, the pilot, allegedly, of the plane that struck the Pentagon. And during this time, Al-Midar left the United States. He traveled back and forth to the Middle East and to Southeast Asia. And as I mentioned before, he renewed his visa after it expired and returned again to the United States July 4th, 2001. This is reported in Newsweek, which did the most extensive of the reporting, but it's also in Newsweek and in the Washington Post of June 4th, and also USA Today. And USA Today stated that 350,000 pages of documents that have been turned over by the CIA to the Congressional Intelligence Committees included memos of al-Qaeda's intentions to launch attacks in the United States. This is after the fact. And that the U.S. operatives had infiltrated both al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Remember, this is USA Today stating that U.S. operatives were infiltrating al-Qaeda and Taliban. The conclusion, the inevitable conclusion, when you know how the intelligence operations work, is that these operatives that infiltrate are the very ones that propose and lead the carrying out of the operations. Ralph.
One of the accused hijackers, Ziad Jarrah, we find, had in fact not been in the locations he was said to be, and the reason is that they were doubles of Ziad Jarrah. There are three passport pictures, each of them different. At the time that Ziad Jarrah was supposed to be in Afghanistan, he was in fact at his parents' home in Beirut, in Lebanon. The Paul Thompson article that delineates this is meticulous in setting forth the false identities of the people who were in fact set up by the intelligence agencies, and those go to another prominent figure who we will discuss in a moment, Zacharias Massawi.
Yes, in the remaining time for this program, let's look at Zacharias Massawi, the Moroccan tracked by the French and in the United States arrested and arrested for immigration, overstaying his stay, but on trial, but a trial that is being kept secret from the people of the United States, a first where the press is not allowed to report on the details of the aspects of the trial, and where Zacharias Massawi has been denied the evidence which would help him in his defense. In fact, the judge has ruled that the government could take back actual notes that were given to Massawi, and there was an intensive search of Massawi's cell in order to take back 48 classified FBI reports that had been handed over to Massawi.
Well, much
of the judge, Leonie Brinkhammer, had ruled that the national security interests of the United States could be compromised if Massawi had even had this classified information.
Much has been made, Maya, of the fact that the Federal Bureau of Investigation operatives and agents who were investigating Massawi were prevented from filing their reports. On August 16, 2001, FBI agents came, and after ascertaining that his visa had expired, did arrest him, but they were prevented from taking any further action. Minnesota-based FBI agents notified the CIA, this is the Washington Times report on September 7th of this year, and the FBI liaison in Paris seeking further information that, quote, Massawi is a known terrorist who has been on the watch list for 3 years. The CIA alerted his overseas station that he was a suspect airline suicide hijacker who might be involved in a larger plot to target airplanes traveling from Europe and the United States. On August 18th, Minneapolis FBI agents sent a 26-page memo to headquarters warning that Massawi was acting with others yet known in a hijack conspiracy. 3 days later, Minneapolis agents notify headquarters, if Massawi seizes an aircraft flying from Heathrow to New York City, he will have the fuel on board to reach D.C. And yet, the FBI reports were prevented from reaching any further higher authority, and indeed no action was allowed to be taken at the time.
And on September 24th, 2002, a Fox News channel reports of the notes made by the FBI supervisor who stated on the Mousawi file, quote, that Mousawi could take control of a plane and fly it into the World Trade Center. Now, that came out in the congressional investigation.
As a matter of fact, Maya, the Wall Street Journal reported on this on May 20th, 2002. This is the report on the FBI report that Mousawi was planning, and I'm quoting from the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Mousawi is planning to hijack an airplane and fly it into the World Trade Center. And the Wall Street Journal continues on the May 20th, 2002, these notes were part of an internal report that never was allowed to leave Minnesota.
Now, not only is Mousawi hampered from engaging in his own defense, he, on July 3rd, 2003, in the BBC, Mousawi seeks Congress appearance. Stephen Kingstone reporting from Washington. Quote, the only man charged in connection with the 11 September attacks has asked to testify before the U.S. Congress. Zacharias Mousawi claims that he and the suspected hijackers were under surveillance by the FBI before September. He says, quote, he has relevant information and proof relating to the conduct of the FBI before September.
He says something very specific, as quoted by the BBC. The United States intelligence agencies were fully apprised. They allowed these attacks to happen. I have the proof. I have the relevant information. I want to present it before Congress. And the next day, the judge declared that there would be no longer any open hearings, nor would any further journalists be allowed, nor would any declarations of Mousawi be reported.
9/11 and the smoking guns. Ralph?
Yes. And indeed, the list of smoking guns is hardly exhausted here. We referred before to the role of the military installations in training these putative hijackers. The vice chancellor of the intelligence agency Monterey School of Languages, Stephen Butler, made an open declaration in which he stated in a public letter that that George Bush and his government had allowed the events of 9/11 to take place, that the intelligence agencies were involved, that he was resigning, and that he was going public with his knowledge of the nature of these events. More to come, more detail, more smoking guns.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Smoking Guns of 9/11. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or write to us at our email, takingaim, takingaim, at pacbell, pacbell.net. Or you can call us at 707-552-9995. Our website is www.takingaim.info for an archive of our programs. Also, CDs and audio cassettes are available. We'll be with you next week.